just ends abruptly, doesn't it? Nice having Jesus looking over me. Well, I try to improve on his message. I don't know how that's possible. I was just thinking, though, when you said we don't usually schedule baptisms, Tim, we don't really need to schedule baptisms because we have a creek that runs through the property. We could do baptisms like on the fly. So if you want to get baptized, we could do that. Tim will do it after the service. We'll all go down to the creek and watch you be baptized. I told the earlier service I'm going to let you know that I do know that I've got these giant ink stains on my pants. My wife did not let me leave the house that way. So I tried to get the earlier service in on my conspiracy to tell her that somebody had come in during the service earlier and thrown ink on me out of the blue and just ran off. But they probably didn't do that. They might have thought I was joking, but I was being serious because now I have to answer for that. Anyway, yes. So today is the first in the series of Sermon on the Mount. And I think the best way for us to start would be to pray. So if you bow your heads with me. Lord, I just thank you for your word. Thank you for being here today with us. May the words I speak not be mine, but yours. May they hit home where you want them to hit home. And I know that as I prepared this message that it spoke to me and that I was convicted. And I would ask that if there's anyone here today that also really needs to hear these words, that you would just impart them in their heart as well as their mind, and that we could all grow as Christians and grow closer to you. In Jesus' name, amen. So, the Sermon on the Mount, what was that about? Well, it's pretty self-explanatory, isn't it? Jesus sat down on the mountain and started praying. And so we'll actually see where it starts in Matthew 5:1. Seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him. So basically, went up, sat down on a mountain, and people started coming around. Well, who are these people? Who are these disciples that started coming to him? To know that, we have to back up a little bit into Matthew 4, the last part of it, chapter 4, 23 through 25. And he went throughout Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction among the people. So his fame spread throughout all Syria. And they brought him all the sick, those afflicted with various diseases and pains, those oppressed by demons, those having seizures and paralytics, and he healed them. And great crowds followed him from Galilee and the Decapolis, from Jerusalem and Judea, and from beyond the Jordan. So, in essence, this whole setup to his sermon that he preached on this mountain was him beginning his ministry in a way that would make sense. So, one, proclaiming the gospel. That's the first thing he's going to do. He's going to proclaim the gospel. And I thought about this in context of the last few weeks' services about not being a closet Christian. And I'm thinking, okay, well, this is the exact opposite of being in the closet. Jesus is out there proclaiming the gospel message. And in a way, that's what we should be doing first before we do anything. So he started by proclaiming the gospel. And then the next thing, I'm like hedged in by these microphones. I feel like bumping into them. So he proclaimed the gospel. Then he attended to people's needs, healing, delivering people, right? And after he's done that, these people begin to throng him from all over. They're coming from everywhere. And I thought about that in context of what Anthony has been preaching and Nathan preached about, this idea of if we get out of the closet as Christians and begin to proclaim the gospel through our lives, through our actions, through our how we carry ourselves, people will be drawn to us, just like Anthony and Nathan talked about. People are going to be drawn to us because they're going to want to know what we have and they want to experience that. So that's how he started his ministry. Then he went up to the mountain and sat down and began preaching. And it's only then, once he has kind of earned the right, basically, to speak into their lives, that he begins to preach to them. The other thing that I thought about this morning that really struck me just literally before I came up was the fact that I was being asked to speak and improve, I guess, or expound upon this sermon that Jesus delivered in the first bit of it. And I'm thinking, well, I don't think that's possible, that a person can now come up here and actually improve what Jesus said. So I'm not going to try to improve anything, I guarantee you. So I'd like this more to be like a conversation about my thoughts about some of these things and what Jesus put on my heart as I was preparing the message. So once again, they came to him. He didn't have to go chasing people down or screaming at them in the street corner. They wanted to hear what he had to say because he had came into their lives and he had met their spiritual needs and proclaimed the good news, proclaimed the gospel. And he would use this model over and over again. If you remember the Samaritan woman at the well, he didn't just like, hey, you need to do what I tell you to do, but he met her needs at that well first. And then he said, hey, this is what you need to know about. So the Beatitudes. I remarked that it seems odd, this word Beatitudes, and I didn't grow up in church. So I didn't have the benefit that a lot of people have of having flannographs and VeggieTale videos to watch to kind of get me prepped up for what God's all about. And this idea of the word Beatitudes is kind of foreign in a way. You don't really use it a lot of times in normal conversation. So it's kind of like, okay, what does that mean? Well, obviously, it's pretty self-explanatory, but it just seems odd. But, you know, the kind of attitudes we're supposed to have. And this is what he started with. So one of the things that the Beatitudes, that is unique about the Beatitudes, is they're not us. I mean, we're not like them. We're not naturally taken to acting the way Jesus told us to act when he was speaking on that mountain. Our normal nature as humans is completely opposite of that. We don't take to these traits naturally, and neither did the crowd that heard them from Jesus' mouth. So some of these things were kind of shocking to them as much as it may be difficult for us to really kind of put into practice. And then what he was really doing is letting us know that as a follower, to become his follower, we will be transformed from into something the world does not understand. And that's one of those things that, again, back to the series on closet Christians. When we act like Christians and behave like followers, and people can see that we're following Jesus in the world, they may not know we're following Jesus, but they're going to see something is different that they don't understand. And I think human nature is, we want to know what we don't know. We're naturally inquisitive. We naturally want to know things. And when we're out there in the world and we're living by the Beatitudes that Jesus is going to share, then people are going to be drawn to us just like they were drawn to Jesus up on that mountain. So let's get right to them. And if you'll read in chapter 5, verse 2, we hear the first of his Beatitudes. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And I read this, again, I've read these Beatitudes, and I'm sure many of you have, multiple times, and then yet when you're studying to speak on a message, you begin to try to dice them and look at them from every angle versus just kind of reading through them. So I started thinking about, okay, what does that mean? Shouldn't we be rich in the Spirit? Why would we be poor in the Spirit? And for instance, isn't that where our treasure is? Where our heart is, there are our treasures. So we should be rich in the Spirit. But I realized that what the example that he was talking about was, he was comparing his followers to like the Pharisees and the religious leaders of the time. And he's saying, look, these guys are all full of the Spirit, But they weren't really full of the Spirit, but they were in their minds, they were full of the Spirit. And I think Jesus was trying to share with the followers that were coming to him is that, look, if you want to be filled with me, then you got to be emptied out. You can't be full of your own spirit or the spirit of the world. You have to be emptied out and a empty vessel for me to fill up. And I thought about the idea he talks later about mixing new wine, putting new wine in old wineskins. That you can't do that, or putting old garment and material and sewing it together with new garment material. It doesn't work because they stretch at different rates, and the wineskins have already been stretched out. And if you put new wine in there and it expands, it's going to explode. And this is kind of what I was thinking when I read this, and I'm kind of processing it, is that Jesus is saying, look, you got to get rid of all that old stuff if I'm going to fill you with new stuff. And it won't mix together. And it's all about our perspective of understanding that perspective of being poor in spirit isn't about not being spiritual, but it's being empty and ready to be filled. Moving to the second blessing in verse 4. Second blessing, verse 4. I don't know how that works. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. And I was thinking about, you know, as we go through life, right, things happen in our worlds. We have losses, we have disappointments, and we mourn those losses. But I was thinking about in terms of light and dark. If we had no dark, we would not really know what light was about. And I think about it the same thing with mourning. If we didn't mourn, then how would we know what it's like to be filled with joy and in all the good things that we're having? And so I think it's important for us to mourn, but it's also important for us as basically followers of Jesus, because we're going to run into people that are hurting, that don't have Jesus, that don't have somebody to comfort them. And if we haven't experienced sadness and mourning and the comfort that comes with that from Jesus, then we're not going to be able to provide that same kind of comfort for people that come to us or that are out there and we run across that are mourning. And I think that's critical, because that is the time, and many of us have experienced that, where people in our lives may be completely turned off to anything we may have to talk about in terms of Christianity or church or anything like that. But when tragedy hits in people's lives, you're going to be the people that they're going to be looking to, because they've seen something different in you. They've seen you turn to something bigger than yourself when you've had losses in your life. And I think that for us to connect with them, we have to have experienced that mourning as well. So he said, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. But there's another side of this that, as I was doing the research for this message, that I came across that I had never contemplated in my life. And it was captured well in an article that I read called Blessed Are Those Who Mourn by Matt Smethurst. And he wrote in this article, he said, sin in the late modern West is not grieved. It's not disapproved. It's not merely tolerated, it's celebrated. Our society doesn't mourn sin, it mourns those who mourn sin. Let me read that again. Sin in the late modern West is not grieved. It's not disapproved. It's not merely tolerated, it's celebrated. Our society doesn't mourn sin, it mourns those who mourn sin. And if you think about what's on the television, what's on the Netflix, what's on the YouTube, the Facebook, what's in modern music, all those things, that begins to kind of like seep in a little bit, like, okay, is what I'm listening to, is what the world talking about is important to us, are they celebrating sin or are they grieving sin? And the reality is, most of the time, most of the influences around us in the world, they're celebrating sin. And this one, probably of all the Beatitudes, this one seemed to like hit me like the hardest in terms of conviction. Like, I let things into my life that celebrate sin, and I don't mourn them. And so in the end of this, for this particular beatitude, is we need to be mourning sin. When sin comes across us in the world, in our entertainment or whatever, we need to be mourning that. And when we do that and we look at mourning in these terms, it completely changes the view of this passage, as you probably are feeling the same thing. It's not about mourning loss, it's about mourning the loss that sin causes. And think about that from God's perspective, it's pretty powerful. And so, yeah, I asked myself, the question I had was, do you mourn for sin? And the answer for me was, I don't. And I realized that that's something that's keeping me from the blessing that Jesus was talking about in his message. Number 3, verse 5. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Often misunderstood, because a lot of people think of meekness as weakness. And I read again an interesting quote, and it was from a tractate on Matthew by Chromatius of Aquila. So, it's got to be good. With a name like that, that guy's got to know something about God, right? And then I didn't even know what a tractate was. I felt like, what is a tractate? So I kind of did some reading, and basically it's just a short treatise or a message, basically, on something. And probably the same, if you've ever seen a Christian tract, same kind of idea, just a short little thing. But anyway, he said, the meek are those who are gentle, humble, and unassuming, simple in faith and patient in the face of every affront. Imbued with the precepts of the gospel, they imitate the meekness of the Lord, who says, learn from me, for I am meek and humble at heart. And I thought about that, and most of the time when we, in human attempts, try to depict Jesus in a video or a movie or something like that, he usually comes off very flat and monotone. That's how we as humans kind of portray his meekness. But the reality is, I strongly believe that there's no way that the person who walked through this world for 3 years of ministry and drew the kind of attention that he did to himself, walked around as just this kind of marshmallowy, mellow kind of guy who just kind of went through life. That is not meekness. And unfortunately, I think it's just our attempt as humans to try to portray it as difficult. And I think it is difficult for us as individuals to portray meekness in everything we do. And notice the absence of the word weak in his depiction because of that worldly understanding. That is not meekness. And so then, as he also indicated, look to Jesus to be our model for meekness. And I think when we do that, it's gives us a different perspective. And I'm going to read that quote again because I think it's pretty powerful, really. The meek are those who are gentle, humble, and unassuming. I'm already convicted. Simple in faith and patient in the face of every affront. I'm very convicted. Imbued with the precepts of the gospel, they imitate the meekness of the Lord. Learn from me, for I'm meek and humble of heart. That's where Jesus is asking us to be. And he says, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. That's a pretty big reward for a little thing. So let's move on to blessing number 4, beatitude number 4. Verse 6, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. So the definition of righteous is acting in accord with divine or moral law, free from guilt or sin. Well, that's Jesus, right? That's the definition of Jesus. And so when Jesus was talking about being righteous, unlike the religious leaders of the day who were self-righteous, that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about being righteous as in pursuing him, pursuing his righteousness with divine moral law, free from guilt or sin. He's the only one that can meet that standard, but we can strive for that. And it's one of the things that, unfortunately, when we get to the idea of being righteous, right, we begin to look at other people. That's usually how it works, right? So if we're getting into the Word and we say, oh, you should be this way and that way, you know what, Adam? you've got a speck in your eye, and you better need to take care of it. But Jesus said, if I have a speck in, or if he has a speck in his eye, I should probably take the timber out of my own eye before I go point out his failings. And that's critical, because as human nature is, we're going to point out everybody else's faults, but we're going to overlook our own. You said, hey, this is not about them, it's about you, each person. So he had a crowd of people, but it was each person, hey, this is about you looking inward, not you looking side to side. And that's the key to righteous, being not being self-righteous, but being righteous in God. And if we're looking at our neighbor, then we're being like the Pharisees, we're being hypocrites, and we're not focusing on what he wants us to do. So the interesting thing that was is how he put that term was, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. And to me, this made this particular beatitude kind of special in that it's it hits home, right? Because most of us as humans, hunger and thirst is our most basic need, right? The first thing we need to do is eat and drink, and that's in order to survive before we do anything else. Well, and I know, like, when I get hungry, my wife could attest, that I get really difficult to deal with. And that's probably an understatement. And I know I was sharing earlier that it's like a car crash. It's like you're in slow motion going off the road, and I can see myself and feel myself doing it, and I know what I'm doing, but I'm powerless to stop that car, it seems like, until I get something to eat. But I think it's interesting that he equated this particular beatitude with the idea of hunger and thirst, because it makes it seem so much more powerful to me, and so much more like just I've got to have this. Like when I'm hungry and got to have some food, and I can't think or do anything else until I get that food. That's kind of what I feel like he's saying for us about that, for righteousness. And if we approached righteousness and the seeking of it from that perspective, think about how that would change in our relationship to God. If we were like that feeling of like, I am hungry, I must have righteousness, I must have it right now before I do anything else. It'd be very interesting how the world of Christianity might change and how we would be looked at from people outside of Christianity. Blessing number 5, and it's verse 7. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. This is a pretty critical, beatitude. There's a couple specific examples that came up to me as I was preparing about mercy that I would highlight. One is that Jesus talks later in his ministry about coming to the altar, right, and having something against your brother, having an offense between you. And he said, whatever you do, leave the gift at the altar. Don't even try to give it to me. I don't want your gift. You need to go be reconciled to your brother. And then when you're done with that, then you can come back and bring your gift forward to the altar. I think that's interesting. The other one is, as humans do, his followers later in his ministry were asking him, you know, like, how many times do we have to forgive somebody that's offended us? So, you know, God was very much into numbers, or is very much into numbers, and so there's different numbers mean have a lot of meaning to them. So they picked one, 7, lucky 7, and so they came to him and said, hey, do we have to forgive people like 7 times? That seems like a lot, 7 times for the same type of offense. And he's like, no, not 7, 7 times 70. Well, that's like 490 times. That's a lot of times to forgive somebody. And I started thinking about that, and I suspect that Jesus wasn't actually saying 490 times. So if you get out of like a little tally and tick it off, and say, like, whoop, I'm done. Yeah, you're out. But that's the importance of forgiveness and mercy, showing mercy to other people. Jesus later said, if you don't forgive others, how can I forgive you? That brings it home. Because of anything I want is forgiveness of my sins so that I can get close to God. I can't forgive you if you don't forgive others. And it's interesting, and I wanted to point out, because it can be easy to step back and go, well, I'm just unforgiving. There's something in my past I just can't forgive. So I guess I'm lost. But that's not the way it works. Jesus isn't saying, look, if you don't forgive everybody that's ever done you anything wrong, you're toast. It's a transformative journey. And you may be sitting in here saying, well, there's something that I just can't forgive. Well, then it's time to start talking to Jesus about it. Like, hey, I'm not ready to forgive, but I want some help. I was equating it earlier with Peter walking on the water. And he's walking and everything's great. And then he realizes, hey, I'm walking on the water. Probably this isn't what I should be doing. So he starts to sink into the water. And Jesus comes out and grabs him and pulls him up. And he's like, hey, why didn't you believe? He's like, and so Peter, pretty smart guy, he says, hey, I do believe. Help my unbelief. So he tells him, yeah, I believe in you, but I realize I don't believe in you completely and I need your help. It's the same thing with forgiveness for some of us. Yeah, I forgive Jesus, but I know I'm holding on to just a little bit of that and I can't really completely forgive. Help my forgiveness. Help me to learn and to be able to forgive that offense. Some offenses are pretty amazingly great. And I don't want to be dismissive of it, and I don't think Jesus was being dismissive of how hurt people could be by other people. And so I want to encourage people, if you're here today and you're having trouble forgiving somebody, don't beat yourself up too much about it. But go to Jesus and ask him for his help. So the sixth beatitude, verse number 8. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the pure in heart, so they shall see God. And this particular one, I'm thinking to myself, later on, Jesus is going to expand, so I don't want to take away too much from down the road, but basically, later he'll talk about that, hey, if you murder, if you have anger against your brother, it's like murdering him. It's in your heart. If you lust after a woman, it's like you've acted on it. It's like you've committed adultery. And that's where, to me, this particular beatitude is bigger than a lot of other religious ideas and concepts about being a good person or trying to be a good person. Jesus was really raising the bar, because all of the Old Testament law was about following the law. And when he got to this particular beatitude, it's not about following the law anymore. It's about what you think in your heart, or think in your head and feel in your heart. They're like, well, how can I help what I think in my heart or what I'm thinking in my head? Well, Jesus will help you do that. And I think sometimes, and again, I feel very convicted by this particular beatitude, but I need it, when I have those things, those thoughts and those ideas, I need to go to Jesus and say, hey, help me not be thinking about this or that way. And part of it is, well, I don't want to go on to that, but this one is hard, to be pure at heart. And I think it's not going to be something that's going to be easy to do, but it's going to be something we're continually have to refresh, constantly hit the refresh button. Part of that that's good, though, is that means in order to do that, we got to go back to Jesus. In order to be pure at heart, hey, Jesus, oh, help me with those thoughts. I shouldn't be thinking that way. I shouldn't be, you know. And that brings us continually back to his feet. So, number 7. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Are you a peacemaker? Or another way of saying that is, do others around you feel at peace? I think sometimes we're not very good peacemakers. Sometimes we're okay with other people not being at peace. Yeah, it's not my problem. It's not my, you know, office politics. Well, it's, you know, it's between the two of them. And you don't want to necessarily butt in, and you don't have to butt into other people's business, but you can still be a peacemaker without butting into other people's business. But I think for us as Christians to be status quo, like, you know what, it's okay if there's a bunch of turmoil here and everybody's kind of on edge because it's not my fault. I didn't do it. Well, Jesus isn't, this is one of those Beatitudes that's proactive. It's not like don't cause strife, because he could have said, blessed are those who don't cause strife. That's not what he said. Blessed are you being a peacemaker. What's interesting is this particular one may have shocked the crowd more than any other of the Beatitudes. And why is that? Well, because they weren't waiting for a Messiah to come and bring peace. They were waiting for a king, a warrior king, to come and help overthrow the Romans and push them out of their lands. So it's interesting that he came and said, hey, you know what? I'm a peacemaker. Blessed are the peacemakers. Wait a minute. The Romans are cruel and they do all these horrible things. Yeah, but we're here to bring peace. Not violence, not war. That's pretty interesting. Another way, by the way, as a Christian, to draw people to you is to be a peacemaker, to draw people to understand what you are about and to learn about Jesus and be interested in what you're interested in. Because there's plenty of opportunities not to be a peacemaker or to help fan the flames of turmoil and problems in your work and school and those things. So Beatitudes number 8 and 9 I kind of combined together because they're kind of very similar in the same vein anyway, and it starts in verse 10 and runs through the rest of the verses. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Before I was a Christian, and again, I mentioned, I think, earlier, is that I didn't grow up in church. I had a view, a worldview of Christianity or being a Christian was that Christianity is for weak people and that it's just a crutch, right? Because otherwise, why do you need an all-powerful God to be, right? So that was my worldview of Christianity and of God, for that matter. After becoming a Christian, I realized very quickly that it's exactly the opposite of that. Christianity doesn't make things easier. It tends to make things more complicated, more difficult. It can cause rifts between us and our family and friends. It can cause us to be looked at as you know, by our peers, by people that we used to hang out with. All of a sudden, we're acting different, and now they don't like that. It can oftentimes helps highlight to other people some of the things in their life that's not good for them and not good for people around them. That can be a problem because people don't like to be reminded of bad things, right? And if they're not looking to try to like be closer to God, then there's not really a reason for them to give up those bad things other than the fact that you're making them feel bad. So for that, oftentimes, we are going to be persecuted for our righteousness. persecuted for seeking God. And people are going to abuse us. We're not going to have always a rosy, wonderful time. At the same time, because we're going through this with Jesus, then we're not by ourselves. We're not alone. There's not just like, hey, I have trouble and nobody's there for me. And so I think that's kind of interesting as well. So some people think that everything is going to be great when they become a Christian. And for some people it is, but it isn't always that way. And more often than not, I think it seems like it's harder, much harder to live like Christ and to follow him and be the way we're supposed to be. And we're not going to be cheered on. By the way, they're not going to be, you go, you're doing great. It's such a good change for you. No, that's not what you're going to experience. So one of the things, in this Beatitude too, these two Beatitudes, is Jesus was beginning to prepare his own followers, his closest followers, for the kind of world they were going to live through. Many of his closest disciples, all of the apostles except John were crucified or were persecuted to the point of death. John was boiled in oil, and he didn't die from that experience, which is kind of amazing, but lived out his life in old age, but he still suffered persecution and, you know, serious persecution. So I think in some aspects in our world, we don't really face persecution like they face persecution. We may someday, but also persecution that other people are living out in the world around us who are Christians in other countries where, you know, they can be just killed on sight or they, you know, they have no rights or whatever. We in Western side of things, in fact, I had something I wanted to read. I missed it. Let's go back. I lost it, so you're not going to get it. You'll have to listen to if the message is on there from this morning. You'll have to listen to that because I had a quote that was really, really poignant. Sorry, that's bad of me to tell you that. I guess I shouldn't make a big deal about it because obviously it's not going to happen. Oh my! So. It's much harder living for Jesus, though, than it is. And so the question then is, why do we do it? Why do we even try this life? Because we long to see the kingdom of heaven, to be a part of it. We long to be comforted. True lasting comfort that the world has never experienced. Jesus said, peace. I'll leave you peace that passes the world's understanding. That's pretty incredible. We long to inherit the earth. Well, not this earth, right? Because it's full of styrofoam cups and polar ice caps that are melting and, you know, big floating piles of garbage in the ocean. But when Jesus comes back, he's going to completely redo the earth, remodel it, and it's going to be like he wanted it to be in the first place. So we long to inherit that earth. We long to be satisfied, not just for a moment, but really satisfied. Jesus said he'd give you stuff to eat that would make you never hunger, never thirst. That's a pretty good satisfaction. We long for mercy, a connection to God, forgiveness for our sins. We long to see God, not just see him, but really be with God. And we long to be called sons of God, to belong, to be a family. Jesus didn't say you're going to be like friends. We have a song about what a friend we have in Jesus. He didn't say you're going to be servants. He said you're going to be children of God, adopted through him. That's pretty crazy when you think about it. That's permanent. You don't become unfamily. Your family, your family. We long to belong to the kingdom of heaven, a permanent home with God. And we long for a heavenly reward, one that can't be corrupted. Most of the stuff that we have, I have to confess, I collect a bunch of stuff. I mean, I have stuff. My wife doesn't like it. She gets rid of stuff very easily. I hang on to stuff. I got a lot of stuff. But the reality is, I know that in the end, I'm not taking any of that stuff with me. Only so much of that will fit in a casket or an urn. It's not going to happen. And the reality is, if I die before her, she's going to throw it all in a big dumpster, probably. If she dies before me, then my kids are going to have a lot of mess to clean up, a lot of mess. But ultimately, my treasure here on earth is not going to help me. I can't take that with me. So we long for a heavenly reward, a heavenly treasure that can't be corrupted, that it's permanent and present with God the Father. And as the worship team comes back up to lead us in worship, So I started with the idea that the Beatitudes do not come natural to us. They're contradictory to human nature. And it's true, but then it's equally true that the promises that Jesus offered for having them, for espousing those things, are something we all long for. I mean, everything that he said, blessed are, this is what you're going to get. Everything that he said, this is what you're going to get, is stuff I want. I'm not always good about doing the first half of it to earn it. It's not earning it, but it's just the natural consequences of living like somebody who's following Jesus. But we crave these things: acceptance, belonging, permanence, forgiveness, mercy, and most of all, we crave fellowship with a loving God. And that's really ultimately the story of the Beatitudes. It's not even as much about how to live our lives, but to be what we are to become, what we are to become transformed into, and what is going to happen as a result of that. And to me, that is that's the core to that message that he sat there, and it was so simple. Jesus didn't have to get real theological. He just, boom, here it is, guys. So as we transition into the music worship portion, just bow your heads. And I, like I said several times, well, pretty much every time, as I prepared for this message, I felt convicted on so many levels, that this message was more for me than anybody else. And but if you identify it as well, then today we're just going to pray. And again, I one of the things I mentioned earlier was, sometimes I've dealt with in youth ministry over decades of time, I've dealt with youth and adults that have come in and said, you know what, I just can't do this Christianity thing, because, you know, everybody's so perfect, and I can't measure up to that. I look at the pastor up there preaching, and he's perfect. The worship leader's up there, and he's perfect. In fact, the whole worship band, everybody leads a perfect Christian life, and I just can't do that. I'm struggling. I can't do that. And they'll walk away, because they feel like they're being rejected because they're unable to do what everybody else is doing. Reality is, everybody in this room is struggling. And if you're struggling today and you need to change your way of thinking and begin to follow Jesus in any one of these areas, just ask him for help to get there. There's nothing I'm going to tell you that's going to make it better, but Jesus, help me. Help me in my unbelief. Help me be merciful. Help me long for your righteousness. Help me, any one of those, all you have to do is come to him and say, look, I'm not good at this, but I want to be. I want to follow you, and I want to be just like you. And it's not going to happen overnight. It might, but it's probably going to be work. Probably going to be us continuing to go back to his feet over and over, And as long as we keep coming back to him, and then that's what this is about. Lord, I just pray that you would just be with us as we leave, as we take this word from you, the simple word that's been made probably way too complicated. But you uttered these promises some 2,000 years ago to your followers. Some of them heard them and went off and left. Some of them went to the grave trying to be like you. Lord, may we be like that. May we go to the grave striving, struggling, fighting to be like you. And you've laid it out for us, an easy, simple recipe. Now, Lord, give us the strength and determination to follow you. Thank you in Jesus' name.